Tonight starts the next section, which I believe is the fourth section, and we'll be talking about mass storage. And essentially, this is storage that is big and cheap. In addition, it's also slow. Well, I'd like to start off by putting mass storage into our system. So we have our computing system, and at the heart we have the CPU. And we already have a memory hierarchy in the CPU. What is that memory hierarchy? What are the memory components of the CPU? No, the CPU, not the system. We'll go expand it in a minute, but just looking at the CPU chip, there are two components, sort of the apex. What I'm going to draw here is a triangle that looks like this. And down here is the mass storage stuff, but I'm looking at the apex here. So what are the two components, there could be more, but let's just say two, of storage in the CPU? Registers, that is at the very top. This essentially has nanosecond access time, sub-nanosecond access time. And it's also very small, right? You have 8, 16, maybe 128 registers in the CPU. So this is extremely small and extremely fast and extremely expensive. Okay, what is the second level after registers? So this is like, I said, 8, which is 32 bytes, to, 128, 256 times 4, so around maybe 1K. All right, what's the second level in, we'll just group these all together, the second level, on-chip cache. So you have, and you have different levels of this. You have L1 cache. It depends on how the architecture goes, but usually have like L1 cache, L2 cache, and maybe L3 cache. And those are roughly 3 nanosecond access times. So now within the chip we have an order of magnitude slower. Wait a minute, is that right? Yeah, because for example, if you have a third of a nanosecond access time, and you go to 3 nanoseconds, that's an order of magnitude. So you have, even within the chip, an order of magnitude increase in access time. So this is registers. The on-chip cache is, let's say, low single digits. And, of course, what's the tricky thing about access time for caches? We'll talk about this more when we talk about buffering in the file system and also, to a certain extent, buffering in a virtual memory. But what's the tricky thing about figuring out what the access time for caches are? Why is it not easy? That's true, and why do I have to do that? That's too detailed. I want to know, why do we even have to worry about what primary... Well, I mean, we're talking about the on-chip cache, right? So why do I have to worry about primary storage? You're right. Okay, I'll take that. The word I was looking for is cache miss.
Oh, okay.
Right? It's possible that you look for something in the cache and it's not there. Then you have to go out to primary store or wherever to reel it in, and that adds to the access time. So if you just talk about cache hits, it's pretty easy to figure out. So when I say low single digits, I'm talking about a cache hit. The effective access time is actually lower than this because you have to factor in the probability of a miss times the access time for primary store. And we'll get to that in a second. So this is low single digit n seconds. So like 1, 2, 3, 4, as I said, nanosecond access times. And it's like, maybe a quarter to 5 or 4 or 8 megabytes. So it's 0.25 to, let's say, 8 mbytes of storage. It depends on, you know, how much you want to devote to caches if you're a CPU designer. But it's usually something like that. It's relatively modest amounts of storage.
Are
the levels of access simultaneously? No, they are. Well, Generally speaking, simply speaking, no. You have the L1 caches, which are closest to individual execution engines. See, the reason it gets complicated because you have not just one execution engine anymore. You have multiple of them. So you have multiple cores, for example. So the L1 caches are usually devoted to individual cores. Those are usually fairly small, 1 megabyte or less. Then behind them, you have the L2 caches, which are shared. So the L2 cache can feed the L1 cache. And then sometimes on some architectures, you also have a third cache, which is the cache of last resort, which is the L3 cache. It depends. Sometimes you'll just have L1 and L2s. But we don't have to get into that amount of detail about it. It's just that, you know, we have somewhere around less than 10 megabytes of this reasonably fast stuff. And then we have to go off chip. And as soon as you go off chip, you're doomed. So we have the CPU. Now we leave the CPU, but we are still within the box. One of the things that we're going to do in this lecture is we're going to go outside the box. So we're going to think outside the box and fill in this bottom part. But while we're still in the box, what's the next level down in our hierarchy? System. No, this is now the CPU and everything around the CPU in a box, let's say. Because actually that's going to be an interesting point. We'll talk about that when we talk about disk attachment. But like, where is the box exactly? That's not an obvious question anymore. But I'll just speak metaphorically and say box. You know, you pick this thing up here and wave it around. So what's the next level of storage? I just told you. Right. Primary store. And here, again, you're looking at the mid to high single-digit nanosecond access times. It depends on a lot of things. It depends on the nature of the bus between the main store, primary store, and the CPU. But roughly speaking, you could say it's around, let's say, 10 nanoseconds. That's a little high, but... And, of course, it could be very large. You could have multiple gigabytes of primary store. So for primary store, you're looking at, let's say high single digits. High single digit nanoseconds to possibly high triple digit microseconds. And up to, I don't know, low double digit, well, let's say medium double digit gigabytes. So, for example, you might be able to buy servers at like 64 gigabyte of primary store. But those are kind of special purpose machines. But you can certainly buy a laptop with got 8 gigabytes in it. So, something like that. Medium, two-digit gigabytes. Now we leave the box. We step outside the box, and this is what we're going to talk about. How do you step outside the box? So this is internal, above this line. And now here we're going to be talking about external. Although, of course, everybody has got a disk inside their system. But we're going to assume that it's actually, I'll put that outside the system. So this is a fuzzy boundary. And we are essentially, and this can be extended to any number of steps, but the first level outside in external storage is disk, and this is what mass storage is here. And essentially what that means is that there are no practical limits. You can run out of address space for primary store, but essentially you can't really run out of mass storage space because you just keep adding more disks. Now, you know, as a practical matter, you may run out of ports or you may saturate the bus, so on and so forth, but not quite theoretically, but at least ideally, you could just keep shoving disks into your system and increasing the storage. So the first level passed in mass storage is the disk, and that's what we're going to be talking about tonight, as well as on Wednesday. And here we're looking at access times that are... So here we have high single-digit nanoseconds. Disk access times, it's very tricky. We'll talk about why that is later on tonight. But roughly speaking, it is in the, let's say, low to mid hundreds of milliseconds. Right, so now we have immediately jumped, what, 3-6 orders of magnitude, right? This is 10 to the 3rd. This is 10 to the 9th, approximately. So we immediately increased our speed. And this is just disk access time. This is not the cost of going over the wire or whatever to the disk. So this is a significant increase in access time. But we also get a significant increase in our ability to access storage. And that is in the, let's say, low single-digit terabytes. All right, you can go up. Sorry? No, did I say faster? I meant to say bigger. It got way slower.
Yeah.
Right, but it also gets enormously bigger. I went looking around today, and you know, you can buy 8-terabyte disks now. Okay, now there may be, actually, you may be able to buy like 16-terabyte disks or anything, but I wasn't looking for specialty disks, just sort of thing you can shove into your system. So you can buy 8 terabytes, well, you can buy single-digit terabyte disks. And that's just one. Of course, you can buy multiples of them. And then past disk is tape. So this is what's known as secondary storage. And of course, there are other forms of disk storage that we'll talk about, optical, so forth. And then past disk is tape. And here you are talking about extremely slow access time. So you're talking about low to mid double-digit seconds. But you're also talking about mid to high double-digit terabytes. You can buy 40-terabyte cartridges for nothing. And then, of course, you can do tricks to turn that into 80-terabyte cartridges. So you're looking at, it's small. They look like, what do they look like? The problem is they're square. So maybe, no, they're not. They're bigger than like a beer coaster, but they're smaller than a paperback book. If you take a paperback book and make it square by cutting off the one of the ends, it looks like that. Yes, turn that into a square. Okay. Turn that into a square. It's like that. And they're called U8 cart. What are they called? I forget what they're called. U8 cart. Right. Yeah. They're used for backups, things like that. So that's low to mid 2-digit terabytes. And then past tape, there are other storage media, which is essentially ganged media. So you take a bunch of robots, you put them in a room, and you arrange the tapes or you arrange the discs or the magnetic beer cans or whatever around the walls, and you have reading stations in the middle, and the robot arms come and move the media from the walls to the reader and writer and back again. Yeah, that's so essentially external or internal, I'm not really distinguishing, although I'm calling them all hard drives. There's really no, as long as you have a bus connection between the disk and the rest of the system, doesn't really matter whether it's inside or outside. But if you're using something like NAS, where you put a network rather than a bus, now you got a different story. We'll talk about that. What kind of tapes are you looking at? What kind of tape is that? That might be like a heritage tape. You know, people are stuck. Like, I would imagine the IRS is stuck with tape drives that were developed in the 60s, right? Because they got archives.
SLR tapes?
Yes, that too. Sorry?
SLR
tape? I don't know what that. I'm not really up on tape stuff. The last time I paid attention to tape was when digital tape first came out. It was called DAT, digital audio tape, and I went berserk because it was the recorder was extremely small, like a pack of cards. It was smaller than a pack of cards, and the cartridges themselves were like matchboxes. Yes, except these were high capacity. These were, you know, high capacity, high quality tapes. But yeah, like the answering machine stuff. And I bought them. They were extremely expensive, but they were small. They were just incredible. And then they pretty much crashed. I mean, they disappeared within 2 years. So, and that was the last time I had any interest in tape whatsoever. So this is essentially the hierarchy of memory, and we'll be talking about what I'm calling external, independent of whether or not it's actually inside the box or outside the box. Yes, we will talk about solid-state memory on Wednesday, if I have the time. Solid-state memory is actually pretty close to disk. in terms of access. And I was actually kind of surprised about this, because you figured, I mean, the thing that makes disks slow is that they're electromechanical devices. Moving atoms is extremely expensive, so you want to avoid doing that. And I would have anticipated that solid-state disks using flash storage would be much faster than a regular rotational magnetic disk. But they're not, in terms of access time. But they are in terms of the entire unit. And the question is, why is that? And we'll talk about why that is tonight, at least in part. Yes. That's a little bit better, because when I talk about networking, you should be able to buy four terabyte U cartridge tapes for like $40. Hewlett Packard, IBM. Yeah, I have no doubt that you can get gouged if you're not careful. But yes, the readers are expensive, but the tapes themselves are relatively cheap. This is the hierarchy. You start off with small, very fast, and extremely expensive, and you go to gargantuan, extremely slow, and really, really cheap. The objective of an operating system is to take all of this variegated memory with its different characteristics, different locations, and so forth, and turn this pyramid into a uniform memory access system that is as fast as the top of the pyramid, in other words, sub-nanosecond access times, ideally. So it's as fast as the top and as big as the bottom. And we will talk more about how that works in the lectures next week, which will be chapter 13. Here, this week, we'll just talk about the actual devices themselves, and next week we'll talk about how the operating system manages them. Depending upon the operating system, but operating systems are surprisingly successful at doing this. Perhaps you're not actually producing storage that has sub-nanosecond access times, but it is pretty fast. It does give you the illusion of having essentially infinite memory. We'll see how you go about doing that in more next week than this. But this is the objective of the operating system in terms of implementing an abstraction with all of these things. So just take all of these things and put them together so that you have this uniform mass storage that's as fast as the top of the storage hierarchy and as big as the bottom. Of course, there's a lot of other aspects. For example, when we get the file systems, that's another important way to bring this about. So we'll take a look at it there, too. That's the last lecture, last section in the course. So we have left, what do we have left? Oh, so this section, so we have three sections left. This one will be mass storage. The next one will be storage management in primary store, in particular virtual memory. And then the final section will be on file systems, which is essentially everything after primary store. So that's the storage management hierarchy. That's where we want to go. That's where we'd like to be. So what we're going to talk about this week is I didn't identify. So disk is associated with secondary store and tape. Oh, now I got to remember how to spell tertiary. I think it is, let me look it up. Thank you. Tertiary storage. And then after that is just offline. Usually the stuff after this is offline storage. Actually, that's not quite true. We have an intermediate, which is one way to think about it is jukebox storage. And then the final step is offline storage. I've identified jukebox storage as essentially robotic. You have a room that has walls filled with shelves, and on the shelves are units of storage like tapes or magnetic beer cans or whatever, and then in the middle you have read-write stations, and in between you have a robot that essentially pulls the storage units from the wall, sticks them in the readers in these read-write stations like that. You have a room full of tapes and tape drives and so forth. And then offline storage is a mine in a mountain that you essentially have trucks that deliver your tapes to. So offline storage is extremely costly. It takes days to get those things. But you essentially have the inside of a mountain, so you have all that space. And that's pretty much where it ends. Okay, so that finishes the... essentially, it is local mass storage. So the problem with tapes is that they are difficult to deal with. They're good for backup, right? So you write stuff to tape, but it's extremely difficult to get that stuff off of tape back into your system. So if you want to provide, the problem with disks is they're expensive. You can buy, like I said, 8 terabyte disks, but I'd imagine that would be extremely costly. Tapes are, yeah, you can look it up first, thanks. Tapes are really cheap. But the problem is, you put something on a tape, it is really hard to get it back off again. So what we'd like to do is get rid of, essentially have the massability of tape, but the ease of secondary storage, and one of the ways to do that is sort of jukebox storage, where you have multiple instances of storage units, and then you swap them in and out of the station. You can literally buy big boxes, like car-sized boxes, that essentially have optical disks in them, and they have, if you've ever seen an old jukebox where the arm grabs the disk and flips it and puts it on the turntable, essentially it's that, except they're delivering it to the read-write heads. So this gives you the capacity of tape. Of course, it's much more expensive than tape, but it is much easier to use than tapes are, because you don't have to essentially mount the tapes. I would imagine terabyte disks probably cost like in the low hundreds, I would think. The problem, of course, is when you start talking about multiple terabyte disks, they're probably specialty disks, and that's like, ooh, we're going to get you on those.
Yeah, I wouldn't
know. You know, it's always the case that you want to have the biggest disks you can get. There, it doesn't matter, because essentially you can just keep expanding them infinitely. I mean, you don't want to sit there and try and fill up your system with half a terabyte disks, right? That would be kind of a waste. Just keep shoving 8 terabyte disks into your NAS system. That would be pretty good. Sorry? Yes, that's true. That's true. But it's NAS. You know, if you don't, you just get another room and buy some more. So what we'll do now, I'll just leave this here, and we'll go over here and take a look at our first mass storage device, which is magnetic disk. Oh, so did I finish talking about solid-state disk, flash storage? It's essentially, roughly speaking, the raw access rate is about the same. It's a little bit faster, maybe, you know, a couple of percentage points faster than accessing a disk. So the question is, where does the performance advantage come? Because solid-state disks are faster than regular disks, right? So the question is, where does the performance increase come from? And this is actually a good point, because it illustrates how tricky it is to talk about performance, these kinds of issues. Exactly. You have to spin the disk. You have to move the arm. We'll talk about that stuff. You don't have any of that stuff with a solid-state device. You do have other interesting things, like the difficulty of doing a write, which we'll talk about on Thursday if we have enough time. But even then, you're still just essentially moving electrons around, so it's going to be much faster. It's not as straightforward as you would like, but it's going to be much faster. So as long as you can avoid, again, moving large assemblages of atoms around, you're going to win. And that's why solid-state disks work better than regular magnetic disks, even though they are approximately the same in terms of read and write speeds. Let's talk about magnetic disks, which you can spell D-I-S-C or D-I-S-K. I usually prefer D-I-S-K. This is essentially, it's a magnetic medium, as are tapes. And in this case, the medium is deposited on an aluminum platter, an aluminum disk, typically on both sides of the platter. And generally, a disk will have multiple platters on it, although occasionally, or a lot of times, you will run across just single platter disks, too. And these platters share a common spindle, so the picture looks like this. And then there is a spindle that goes through, and the rotation is, I don't know whether it's clockwise or counterclockwise, maybe it doesn't matter. And again, there's magnetic medium on both sides of the disk, of the platter. The rotational speeds on the disk are usually somewhere around, mid four-digit RPMs to low five-digit. 4,700 or 7,200 to maybe 1,200, 1,500 RPM. The disk size can vary. It's somewhere between, and this is the diameter of the disk, it's somewhere between 1.5 and 5.5 inches. And of course you have specialty disks and so forth, but usually it's in this range. They're relatively small disks, which makes sense, because if you're going to spin something at like 10 to 12,000 RPM, it's going to be small. It's really actually the physical packaging associated with disks is amazing, because you have to think about it. I mean, you have to carry these things around, and they can be subject to all kinds of shocks, physical shocks in terms of dropping it or doing it, tipping it sideways or whatever. And it has to withstand all of those forces and yet still work. And the tolerances, as we'll talk about, is quite amazing. All right, so that's the medium, and now we need to have, so that's the storage medium, and we need to have some way to read and write the data on the medium. So we need a read-write mechanism, and essentially it is similar to what you use for a tape. So you have a small surface that has electrodes in it that can be magnetized by electric current, and unlike tape, which you can actually pull the tape over the head, as we'll talk about later, in the case of disks, you cannot have the head touch the surface because the surface is moving at high rates of speed. All right, so essentially what has to happen is the head has to essentially float, and in fact what actually happens is it flies just above the surface of the magnetic disk. And that's how the reads and writes go through, and in order to do that, the head looks kind of like an airplane wing and relies on Bernoulli flow to maintain the gap distance between the head and the disk. So the read-write mechanism is actually a small wing. There would be actually 16. There would be 8 arms. Oh, here, yes. In this example, you're right. There would be 4 arms, one for each platter, and then at the end of the arms would be read and write heads for the top and the bottom surfaces of each platter. So we have small wings. Those read write heads are mounted on arms, and the arms are attached to an actuator, which is responsible for moving the arms and therefore the heads. So in this picture, for example, this would be the actuator, and then there would be an arm that comes off, and then you would have the upper read head and then the lower read head underneath. And in this case, the actuator would move in and out in a direction that is, let's see, what would that direction be? That would, I guess, be a radial direction from the spindle. Okay, so it would either get closer or further away from the spindle, and that would move the head in and out. There is an alternative approach, which is to rotate the actuator, and that would essentially swing the read-write heads on an arc over the disc. So this would be like a record player. How many people have seen record players? Okay. How many people have record players? You do? What kind? Essentially, so this in this case, you would have a radial movement. And that's pretty much, I mean, there's, like I said, there's lots of things we could talk about, but this, I'm just going to leave it at that. Does anybody have any questions about this? The reading and writing goes on in parallel. You don't have selective choice over heads, although when we get to RAID, that will actually change a little bit, not quite, but it's essentially you're reading and writing in parallel, which gives you an immediate speed up there. So parallel, non-selective operation. Are there any questions about this? Because this essentially is going to sort of indicate how it is we're going to structure the magnetic surfaces, which we'll do when we talk about formatting. Okay, so let's go on and talk about that then. So what is the organization of data on a disk? We've got it set up so that we have magnetic surfaces. And what are the magnetic surfaces? Actually, I don't know that this is true. Probably not true, so let me not say. I don't know what the magnetic surfaces are these days. Oh, there is one other thing I wanted to talk about, and that is bit densities. Let's do that in a minute. All right, so this is the physical setup. So now what is the organization of data on the disk? When we talk about writing data to the disk, what are we talking about? What does that look like if you could look at it? And there are, in fact, forensic devices that will allow you to look at the orientation of the magnetic field on a disk and essentially read the bits. You can, when I say, what does it look like, I'm actually talking about something that you can do if you so desire. So the organization of the data more or less follows the structure that we see here. So as the disk rotates past the head is essentially tracing out what's known as a track, a circular track on, and I'm just going to say a surface, but remember it's going on the underside of the disk as well as all the other disks too, but I'm just going to talk about a single surface as an exemplar of all the other surfaces. So we have a circular track per surface, okay, which is where the data are written. And then as we move the head in and out, we change the tracks. So we have essentially a concentric ring of tracks on the disk. And again, it depends on how it gets formatted. Those are usually, well, we'll talk about that in a minute. Now that's a single surface. We have multiple surfaces going here, so for each position of the actuator, we have a bunch of heads that are tracing out tracks on each surface. Those collection of tracks are what's known as a cylinder. Well, let me not say all tracks, let me say tracks on all surfaces. Okay, so expanding the track, we see that we get a bunch of cylinders, which correspond to the tracks on an individual surface. And then looking inside a track, we see that a track consists of sectors, which are usually in the, let's say, 0.5, let's say 0.25 to 1, 0.5 to 1 kilobyte range. Usually it's 512 or so is the usual track sector size. So we have sectors per track and then tracks per cylinder. And that is the way that the data are organized. And in particular, you have an increasing sequence of sectors, which starts at, for example, the top surface and goes from 1 to n. Okay, and then on the bottom surface, it goes from n plus 1 to 2n, and then on the top surface of the next disk. So essentially, you have one way to think about it. Is a spiral down a cylinder, and then when you reach the end of that cylinder, you go on to the next. Generally speaking, the cylinders and tracks are numbered from outside in. So this is track 0 at the outside outer edge, and this is track n minus 1 if you have n tracks per surface. And that represents the raw structure of the disk. Just one actuator. You have multiple arms on an actuator. I seem to remember disks that had multiple actuators, too. So, for example, you would have one actuator had the upper surface, and then the other actuator had the lower surface of all the platters. I don't remember why they did that. No, there's one arm per disk. There's one actuator per unit, per disk unit. And then you have arms that come off the actuator, and then the arm splits into two heads, one for the upper, one for the lower. But I have seen disks in which there were two actuators and you had arms for the upper surface of each disk on one of the actuators and arms for the lower surface of each disk on the other actuator. Well, why would you do that? What would be the point there? All right, we'll come back to that in just a sec. What would be the point to having two actuators? You have two independent read-write activities, so essentially you double the throughput through your disk. So that's one argument for having multiple actuators. But it's also probably a lot more costly. That sounds like a military thing. So I suspect that's what that was, but I'm not sure. For the vast majority of disks, they have a single actuator, multiple arms, and then for each arm, two heads. I'm pretty sure they're not magnets.
Yeah.
No. I'm surprised because, of course, these are magnetic surfaces.
I know. Really.
So you would not expect magnets to be. You might be talking like magnetic bearings is what you're talking about, right?
Yeah,
you, the spindle is levitated, essentially. I don't know about that. I don't know. That is possible. We'll talk about RAID. When we talk about RAID, we'll talk about that. That would be a situation where you would do things in parallel. Here, you're essentially doing one head at a time. Yes. Well, that's based on your ability to get data off the disk, however you do that. And that's usually going to be with a single head doing the reading and writing of a particular track. And then as you fill up that track, you go on to the track on the underside of the cylinder, and then you'd switch the heads. Not in this kind of, you'd have to go to RAID for that. Now, again, there may be specialty disks that do that. I don't know. Any other questions? All right, so let me talk a little bit about bit densities. For magnetic disks, the bit densities this is sort of top of the line, but you can get up to 800 gigabits per square inch on a mag disk, which is pretty good, actually. Maybe within a couple years, you will see terabit per square inch on a mag disk. And then underneath this, you would have stuff like Blu-ray, which, as soon as I say Blu-ray, does anybody want to make a comment about that? Well, one comment you might want to make is, oh, this is not fair, right? Because this is a magnetic medium that we're talking about. Here, we're talking about a physical medium. In fact, the rest of these we're going to be talking about are physical mediums. And Blu-ray is like in the tens of gigabits, right? Yeah, Blu-ray is like 10 to 12 gigabits. But, of course, Blu-ray and, well, let me just continue. So there's Blu-ray, there's DVDs. Okay, DVDs is what? Is like in the single digits, 2 gigabits. 10 to 12 gigabits per square inch. DVDs and then CDs are just in the, 6 to 8, I believe. Well, actually up to 9 or 1 or so. So that's around 900 megabits per square inch. Now, of course, the problem here is that mag disks are essentially, you're talking about the magnetic domain, but Blu-ray, DVDs, and CDs, how do they work? Yes, they're optical drives, but how does an optical drive work? Yeah, you drill little pits in the surface of the disk, right? So this is actually a physical process. Well, magnetic disk is also a physical process because you're dealing with magnetic domains here. But these are, you know, you're actually burning holes in aluminum or whatever they use as a substrate. Oh, and that's the other thing to emphasize is that in the disk, we have circular tracks. Okay, but what do we have in Blu-ray, DVDs, and CDs? Does anybody know offhand? You have spiral tracks. So you have essentially one big track for Blu-ray, DVDs, and CDs. So these are spiral tracks. That will actually be important when we take a look at how these things get read and written. So that's it for densities. So you can see there's a fairly dramatic drop-off from almost 1 terabyte to, you know, 10 or so gigabits. I'm sorry, I said terabyte, didn't I? This is also wrong. This should be terabit. No, I'm sorry. This is almost 1 terabit. This is 800 gigabits. That's all I'm going to talk about now. We'll come back to this later on. So now we will stuff all of that into a box. So now we'll take a look at packaging. And essentially the way you can look at it is there are two parts to a disk. There's the box, and then you have the actual disk itself, the hardware, the arms, the platters, the actuators. And then in front of that you have the electronics, which the book is a little inconsistent in, they call it a controller. I prefer to think of it as, no, they call it the driver. And I prefer to think of this as the disk controller. Or the textbook calls it the driver. It doesn't really matter, but the thing you have to be careful of is when we stick this box in our system, we will see that the operating system has a corresponding component to each one of these disks, and that component is going to be either the driver or the controller. So you need to pick one term and stick with it. And I usually say that the controller is in the disk, and then the driver is in the operating system. The textbook doesn't really pick a particular use like that, so you have to be a little careful when you read the book. The disk controller contains all the electronics. This is the physical stuff. The controller is responsible for driving all that physical stuff as well as handling the interface to whatever the disk gets attached to. All right, so this is the electronics. That is essentially working the physical parts, implementing the interface to the rest of the world. So inside the controller is a microcontroller, and that's why I call it a controller, because there's actually a little CPU in here. Actually, sometimes it's not so little. Some disks have, for example, MIPS chips in them, RISC chips, 32-bit RISC chips. I usually think of them in terms of microcontrollers, so that's why I call them disk controllers. It also has buffering and all kinds of other things. And in fact, there has been a general trend. In the olden days, the operating system was essentially responsible for driving the disk. The controller was either absent, well, it couldn't be completely absent because you still had to do some protocol conversion here. We'll talk about that in a minute. But it didn't really do that much. And then as microprocessor technology advanced and controllers became more capable, there began to be a general migration of function from the operating system to the disk devices. So there's been a general migration of function. And if you're sufficiently old and you've been installing operating systems for a long time, you realize this because, for example, FreeBSD, when you installed a new disk like 20 years ago, you had to go through some fairly complex calculations figuring things out, like what is the maximum travel that the ARM can go through, you know, how big is the disk. You had to figure out or at least specify a lot of fairly complicated parameters so the operating system knew how to drive the disk with a fair degree of efficiency. Okay, but what happened is as the controllers became smarter, first of all, they could learn that information firsthand by querying the disk, and secondly, they could do those calculations themselves. So that function sort of migrated from the operating system into the disk. So now you just sort of stick the disk in and indicate where it is, and that's it, you're done. In addition, there's also higher level issues such as, for example, buffering and error correction, as well as queue management. We'll talk about that in a couple of minutes. So there has been a general, and this is in general true, devices are getting, of any kind, are getting smarter and migrating function from the operating system into the device itself, which is nice in one sense, but also on the other hand, that means that the operating system loses the ability to do optimizations. In general, I think that's a win, because doing optimizations is a fairly difficult thing, particularly with a complicated entity like a disk. So we have our disk then split up into the controller and the actual physical stuff. Generally speaking, the operating system deals with the controller because they're smart enough to hide all the features of the disk. And then we have a connection between the disk and the rest of the system. And this connection can be of two kinds. One is it can be a bus-based connection, which is essentially a set of wires. The other possibility is that it's a network. For example, beloved TCP, or perhaps fiber channel is an example. And we'll talk about the difference of these between these two things in a couple of minutes. Now, over the connection between the system and the device, the disk, I will say device now talking generically because this holds true, for example, for tape drives, for printers, well, printers are a little different, scanners, you know, all kinds of things that you can add to your system, bamboo tablets, whoa, those are a pain, but yeah, bamboo, things like that. So you have a bus or network, but you have some mechanism for delivering electric signals from the system to the device and vice versa, and over that network travels some protocol. Protocol is responsible for doing device identification and management. So example protocols, things like ATA, SCSI, what are some other ones? I'd have to look. EIDE, oh, how could I forget? So there's IDE, EIDE. Which one am I forgetting here?
USB.
In each one of these cases, management is actually fairly complicated. You can think of it as existing in two different domains. One is multi-device management. In other words, attaching more than one device to the same connection. So this, you can think of this as being like multiplexing. And then managing the individual devices, which is essentially, you know, what device are you, what capabilities do you have, here's a read operation, here's a write operation, things like that. I will just generically call those I/O operations, but they could be more advanced than that. Status requests, reset operations, things like that. This is done using various protocols. Some of these you can look up. For example, USB protocols. I don't know about SCSI. I actually have a document that describes an early SCSI protocol. The early SCSI protocol, it changes as time goes on. In the system, as I mentioned earlier, you have sub-portions of the operating system that are responsible for taking input from the rest of the operating system and consequently from user processes and translating them into the language of the protocol, for example, SCSI or USB or SATA. We will look more at this next week. This will be more or less the topic of the discussion for next week's lectures. And then this week we'll stay over outside the box I'm pretty much done with the discussion of the interconnect, until we get to networks. In fact, why don't we get rid of that now? So this is a bus base, which is essentially like a ribbon cable or whatever. But you can also stick a regular network in there. And I think I mentioned this earlier. One of the great things you can do with operating systems is wherever you see a wire between two components, you can take that wire and replace it by a network. And ta-da, you have a distributed operating system. And that's what people did early on when they took the ribbon cable that connected the disk to the rest of the system and stuck a network in the middle. Xerox PARC was the first people to do this, or at least the first that I know of to do this, back in the, I guess this would be the 80s, the early 80s, late 70s with Ethernet. As a consequence, what you get is your disk is out over the network. In one sense, there's no difference between this and having a bus, having a wire. But in another sense, it's actually a lot more useful because you have increased sharing. Disks are noisy devices. They require power and they make noise themselves. So it's nice to be able to get rid of your disk to move it someplace else. And you can certainly do that if you put a network in between your system and the disk. And there are other reasons for doing this. You can have better reliability by essentially providing redundancy in the network, right? If you have one ribbon cable, then if there's something, well, generally speaking, ribbon cables don't go bad, but if you have a network, then you can have multiple routes from one system, one host, to the disk or the set of disks, and that provides for greater reliability. You can also play tricks. It's easier to play tricks on the device end of the network by, for example, doing replication. Right? You can replicate a disk 3 or 4 times and not have any consequence to the system other than the possibility of increased reliability or more capability or whatever. On the other hand, if you have a ribbon cable, right, it becomes fairly clear when someone puts 3 more disks on your system because you've got a big stack of them sitting next to your box. Right, so essentially I can, if I have a network between my system and my disks, a network area, right, a NAS or a SANS, one or the other. We'll talk about those in just a second. If I can remember the difference, one of my difficulties in life is remembering the difference between network area storage and storage area networks. If you have one of those things, if you have a network between your system and the disks, it becomes very easy to increase the number of disks in a way that essentially leaves the system untouched. Whereas if I wanted to triple the number of disks in this system, I'd have to actually either, you know, open this up and stick the disks in, and if it doesn't have any free slots, then I have to have an outboard box and things like that. I guess I'm not understanding the distinction there. Yeah. Oh, no. I'm talking about hardware. Yes, but in order to do that, you would have multiple disks to do that, for example. Right, this is where so this is the disk, and this is the system. No. Right, so I can do this. Okay, and there's two ways to do this. One is to just use your old network. I mean, you've got a network, right, because most systems are hooked up to a network. So the way you can do it is, well, you've already got the network there, so just stick the disks on it and maybe have some sort of front end to it. And that's what's known as network area storage. This is one way to characterize this is you use existing networks. All right, now this is nice because, like I said, we already have Ethernet installed in this building. So I don't have to do anything special. I can just exploit the existing infrastructure and stick my disks on the network. Now, there's some problems with this. So the advantage here is that I have to do a minimum amount of work to lay the infrastructure. So the infrastructure exists, and that's nice. That's really important, in fact. But there are some disadvantages. First of all, the network is not optimized to deal with disk traffic or mass storage traffic. This is not to say that it can't be optimized, but it would require extra work. And in addition, you have an increased traffic. One of the advantages you have in taking your disk out of your system and moving it somewhere else on the network is that you now have more space for primary store, which you're going to need because you want big honking buffers, because you really don't want to go out over the network. So you have increased traffic. You also have non-optimized operation unless you work at it. So an alternative approach to doing a network is to create a special purpose network, which is called Storage Area Network, which is abbreviated SANS. For some reason, NAS is usually, well, of course, it ends in S, but SANS is usually plural, even though you're only talking about one. And here you have a network that is designed specifically for mass storage traffic. So this is a special purpose network. So our favorite existing network is, of course, Ethernet. And our second favorite, perhaps, most existing network is HTTP. And there have been file systems implemented over both of those. Ethernet, of course, is like iSCSI, Internet SCSI, and HTTP is the Common Internet File, CIFS, I think. It's Microsoft's Common Internet File System. But there have been plenty of them. I actually implemented one at a job I had to implement a very simple remote storage system. So we create a special purpose network. Examples of this are fiber channel. What's the other one? The other one, it's a ring. I've just forgotten the name. HPI, high performance peripheral interface. So both of these, well, actually FC can be copper, but usually both of those are optical networks and they're ring based. So we have a special purpose network that just carries the traffic for the storage devices. So in this case, the infrastructure usually doesn't exist, so it has to be installed. So that's the minus, but the plus is we now can have optimization, and we also get the traffic off the regular network and put it on the SANs, where in theory it is engineered to be able to deal with that much more efficiently. What else do I want to say about the interconnections? I don't think there's anything else. Anybody have any questions about this? All right, bus base, simple, fast, cheap, network attached, storage area network, blah, blah, blah. Okay, any questions? So what have we done? We've done this, 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 and this. I don't want to talk about scheduling. It's boring. So let's talk about management, disk management. And then at the end, we'll talk about scheduling. Going to extend this, so I will leave that up, and I will erase this. When I first learned about network area storage and storage area networks, I got it wrong. I essentially said, the way I thought about it was, well, network area storage essentially, and this is because I actually learned about network area storage from Unix and Plan 9 in particular. So I said to myself, oh, network area storage, that is where you make the disk blocks, available over the network. Okay, so essentially that's like saying you have a remote disk block server. That's network area storage. And SANs, storage area network, you make the file system available over the network. So it's a higher level of abstraction than network area storage. Rather than just making the disk blocks available, you make the entire file system available. That is completely wrong, and that's why I had a hard time understanding the difference between network area storage and storage area networks. The other problem was whenever I tried to look up the difference, I always got marketing stuff, which told me absolutely nothing. But eventually I found something that said, no, this is what it is. And I said, oh, that makes sense. So the difference is, how would you characterize it since I just erased it? Right, it's the type of the network. Network area storage, you use a general purpose network that you use for everything else. In SANs, you have a special purpose network that's used only for mass storage traffic. That's it. Okay, so now we're going to talk about disk management. So we have our system. We have some connection to the disk. Now what? Well, the first question we might want to ask is, what does the disk look like to the rest of the system? So what kind of interface does the disk controller present to whatever it's connected to? And essentially, the answer is, it is an array of sectors. Right? It starts at 0, and it goes up to n minus 1, where n is the total number of sectors in the device. So this is how the rest of the system deals with the disk. It says, write me this sector or read me this sector. Or sequence of sectors. It depends on the nature of the protocol, but usually you're allowed to gang together reads and writes. So you can say, starting at this sector, read the next Q sectors, let's say. the disk appears as just a straightforward array of sectors, and then you can read and write those things as you see fit. And as I said, in the olden days, the operating system was entirely responsible for providing that abstraction. Nowadays, the device, the disk controller, is almost completely implementing this abstraction. So the system has very little to do, and in fact, it just uses the protocol as if it were talking to an array of sectors. Are there any other structures? So this is what the protocol presents, and the question is now, what does the system do with that? And essentially what happens is three things happen. First, we have a low-level format, which is the thing, or, yeah, let me say this, which is the thing that defines the array of sectors. So this is how you define that array of sectors. Low-level formatting is done by the manufacturer. All right, so there's really not that much that the system can do, although there is a little influence it may have depending upon the nature of the protocol that's used. The next step up from that is partitioning. And that is essentially something that the operating system does. And this consists of creating, from a single actual physical disk, multiple virtual disks. So here is our physical disk. Okay, it's an array of sectors. And when the operating system partitions the physical disk, what you get is you get a subarray of a bunch of you get a bunch of subarrays, each one of which is treated as a separate disk, logically. So we have logically separate disks. Why do this? What will be the point of doing partitioning? Principally, it's a mechanism for improving reliability. We'll talk about errors in just a second, but generally speaking, if you have a contiguous array of sectors that you're treating as a disk, and something happens in that contiguous array, like, for example, you have a head crash, then the entire array is destroyed. Okay, so if you subdivide your disk up into partitions, then, let me reposition that X a little bit more expeditiously. So in this case, if this system, if this virtual disk incurs a head crash, then these other two portions, virtual disks, are unaffected. So there's you can do with partitioning, you can essentially increase reliability of the system. There are other reasons you can increase performance, because as we'll see when we talk about disk or mass storage performance, the more information that you have about the way in which a disk is going to be used, the more you can optimize it. That makes good sense. Yes? It's not so much the whole disk that gets destroyed. It's just a little piece of the disk. But the problem is that will take out the information that's over. So essentially what happens, the third step is going to be we overlay a file system on each partition. Okay, now if you have a head crash in a partition, there's a good chance that you're going to destroy your file system because the information is going to be gone that you need to maintain. The metadata that you need to maintain the file system is going to be destroyed. And so that file system is done. So it's not as if you have a head crash over here, then this part of the disk is destroyed. Okay, or something. Well, it depends on the nature of the error, but generally speaking, once it goes bad, it's bad forever. So it's non-recoverable. Now, there are things called soft errors. Yes, they'll be fine. And in fact, everything around this area here, let's assume that we have a localized problem. All the other portions of this disk are fine, and they can be used. The problem is, if you have a file system on here and... Right, so the data is gone, and if the data are gone, then there's really not much you can do to recover the layout of the information here. Now, you might be able to do it. It depends on how much redundancy you have in your file system. RAID 1 is mirroring, right? The way you would do RAID 1 on one disk is you would have two partitions. You would treat those as being mirrored. So every time you write one partition, you would write the other partition. So it wouldn't be stupid, because if one of those partition goes, then you just go to the other one. Right, exactly. Normally you would, but you could do RAID 1. There may be technical reasons why you can't. Maybe the assumption is it's a multiple disk system. You could certainly think about doing mirroring on a single disk using partitions. Let's just say that, as opposed to RAID 1, which may have technical requirements that require multiple disks. But mirroring on a single disk is a fine idea. Except, of course, what? Exactly, you lose half your address space. But disk is cheap, right? So okay, so that's enough of that. And in the third, yes, that's true. That's true. The third one is then putting file systems on top of partitions. Yes, that's one possibility. Right. You can have ISAM. You could have an ISAM partition, things like that. Another possibility is, for example, swap space. Probably don't want to mix swap space with your regular file system, although most operating systems let you do that. So what you'd like to have instead is you'd like to have a swap partition, and then you'd have another partition for your file system, right? Because swap gets used in a way, it has operational characteristics that are different from the operational characteristics of a file system. It is done from main memory into the disk and vice versa. We'll talk about that. That's one of the things I should mention. This is chapter 12, so I have jumped ahead. So I skipped over, in fact, the chapters on storage management and file systems. So as you read chapter 12 and chapter 13, it will make references back to file systems and occasionally references back to virtual storage. I hope that won't be too confusing to people. I mean, you can sort of figure out what they're talking about by the nature of the examples they're giving. But this is, we have jumped ahead in the text over some chapters that you were supposed to have read before you got to 12 and 13. Okay, so you can lay down file systems, and I'll have a lot more to say about that in the last section of the course. Disk formatting. Okay, we just did that. All right, so let's talk about errors next. Errors are another example of where functions have migrated from the operating system out to the device. It used to be that the operating system was responsible for making sure that no bit errors occurred when the data are read or written, usually when the data are read from the disk. And there are a number of ways that that can be done. Generally speaking, if the operating system is doing it, you're going to have block-level error detection. So you're going to have error detection over the sectors. If you migrated out to the disk, to the disk controller, you can have byte-level error detection. So you can assign error detection codes on each byte that gets written. So you can have finer granularity when you move the errors out, the error detection out to the disk. And there's usually two kinds of errors, a soft error and a hard error. And the difference between the two is usually what happens is when the disk controller detects an error in data that is usually read, although also could be written, it will essentially retry that operation a couple of times. So a soft error is an error that disappears after retry. And the assumption here is that it's a transient error. Now, if it doesn't disappear, it becomes a hard error. And that's not how you spell disappears, is it? There's only one S. Is that right? Disappears after retry. And hard error, it's non-transient. So soft errors can be hidden by either the device controller or the operating system. And then hard errors are a problem because this implies data loss. In the occurrence of a hard error, that essentially means that the sector associated with the data that occurred the hard error is bad. So this produces bad sectors. And another aspect to error management is dealing with bad sectors. And there's essentially two ways to deal with it. One is, well, there's only one way to deal with it, is you have to remap those sectors. So I said that we can treat the array as the disk as an array of sectors, which essentially suggests a fairly straightforward mapping from what the operating system sees to what the disk actually presents. And that would be correct if it wasn't for the problem of dealing with bad sectors. So the way that you deal with bad sectors is you remap them. And the way that you do that is you essentially have, in fact, two arrays, one of which is hidden. So you have the data array, which is the array of sectors. Okay, and this is the public one. And then you also have a private array, which is an array of spares. And this one is maintained by the disk itself, by the controller itself. And what happens is, as sectors go bad, they are replaced by sectors from the spare array. So the mapping suddenly changes, right? Rather than going from 1 to, let's say in this case we're going from 0 to 0, here we go from 1 to 1, 2 to 2, so forth and so on. Now, if sector 1 disappears, we have to change this mapping and say that we're going from 1 to, I don't know, 1024. All right, because let's assume this is 1024. This is what's known as sector sparing. Okay, so that's a pretty obvious idea. Right, you just when you get a hard error in a sector, you say that's a bad sector and you remap it to one of the spare sectors. What's wrong with this? Is this satisfactory or is there a problem here? And since we're running out of time, I'll just tell you. There's a problem here, and that is the most efficient way that you can use a disk is sequentially. You can access the disk starting at one sector and then just run adding one to the sectors that you're accessing. All right, that is the most efficient way that you can drive a disk, and that's the way that the operating system is going to attempt to drive the disk. Sector sparing screws that up, because now instead of going 0, 1, 2, you're going 0, 1, 1024, 2. Right? So now you're jumping around the disk. That's much less efficient. So we'd like an alternative approach to sector sparing, and that's what's known as sector slipping. And in this case, what you have is you essentially split the array up into pieces. Some of these pieces are public, and some of these pieces are spares. So essentially what the mapping does is it makes the public pieces look like this, and then you have interspersed this spares array. So we essentially just shuffle them together. We have ruined our nice sequence operation here, because even though you have runs of public sectors that are actually consecutive, eventually you're going to hit one of these segments that contain spares and you're going to have to jump over it. So that's the trade-off there. But what's the advantage now? The advantage is if you get a bad sector, so let's suppose that this sector goes bad, how do you deal with that? Right, you skip it, but how? I mean, we skipped it over here, right? But the way that we skipped it with sector sparing wasn't very nice, because it essentially made us jump radically around the disk.
Use one of the spares better.
Exactly. So the idea is what you do is you take this portion of the disk, this portion of your public sequence, and you move it up one sector like this. So you overlap into the spares. Okay, now again, that induces a jump, but this jump is not nearly as bad as the jump which you get with sector sparing, right? Because essentially you're moving in the same direction, and you essentially just stop reading for a sector and then continue to read. All right, so this is a much nicer way to deal with the errors that you can get when you start encountering hard errors in a sector. And again, all of this stuff is done pretty much invisibly to the operating system, because the controller will take care of it. Let's see, do I want to say anything else? Do I have anything else to say? Well, there's some other things we can talk about. Like, for example, there can be reporting back to the operating system. So, for example, if there's a lot of soft errors occurring, they can be recovered, but the operating system should know about this. And, for example, there are utilities on Linux, for example, called Smart. I forget what that's called. Does anybody know? Something to do with monitoring your devices to make sure that they're operating at reasonable efficiencies. And so Smart would be one of these subsystems that would receive the reports from the disk controller about the existence of soft and possibly hard errors on the disk. And then it could determine whether or not, based on statistical analysis of prior devices, for example, what the expected lifetime of the device is. For example, Google is really heavily into this because they have hundreds of thousands of disks, and they are interested in the next one that's going to fail. I guess we're out of time. So I pretty much covered everything I wanted to cover. Does anybody have any questions?